Chapter 5, Why a Wrestling Match, in which a Christian upbringing, often advertised as being the answer to everything, the provider of comfort, and an all-around lucky thing to have had, is minutely and very subjectively examined in a slightly less rose-tinted light than is customary. For some, going out to church, singing the songs, voting Republican or conservative, and taking certain stances on gun control, capital punishment, abortion, and same-sex marriage is more than enough fun, apparently, in terms of Christianity. Fills up their time. Tom Wright points out that in any country other than the United States, if you say you're a Christian, no one is likely to assume they A. know how you vote, and B. what your positions are on all of these issues. For what it's worth, some don't seem to need anything more than mostly saying hooray for our side. It keeps them content, no wrestling required, except with anything or anyone who seems different or who wants change or growth of any kind. If you're like me, though, Christianity becomes a relationship thing more than an ideology, membership, or political stance thing, and like most relationships, it's going to take work. I've been asked, what does that mean, it's a relationship thing? It means that, although I am very open to the idea that there might be shoulds or supposed tos in my life, I am trying to discover God as something other than simply structure, boundaries, ethics, and limits. I want to feel like He's involved in the world in more ways than just that. I want to let Him be a person, not just a standard for behavior. But it's a relationship. You have questions. You feel a need to go deeper. You are starting to realize that no matter what anyone says, it isn't simple. You may even feel that God is needing you to have some private chats with Him, and that the discussion may get heated, and you start to be more and more certain that not too many other people are having these kind of chats with God, as far as you can tell. If you're a teenager, and your church is a place where you fit in, it's life-affirming, I'm told. If it's a safe place where you trust people and there's warmth and kindness, then even if you don't continue in it when you're an adult, it's a warm, fuzzy memory. It's like Santa Claus. But if church is just one more place where you're being asked to sing and say and think and do things that seem to go against your conscience, your reason, your heart, and your connection with God, then it's something that can tear you in half. And it's endlessly confusing. Because for kids, the distinction between God Himself and the adults who are talking about Him but perhaps doing dubious stuff is a hard one. Kids are always very upset and confused and angry and bitter over adults who are suddenly revealed to be very, very human, flawed like we all are. They're not ready for how hard it is to be an adult, how easy it is to screw up. They see every single thing every adult around them does wrong. But they don't know how hard it is to do better. The gospel is that because human beings can't be and do and live as well as one might hope or God requires, Jesus came and lived a human life, fulfilled every divine expectation, and now we're accepted by God. And God is able to work within us to transform us into the image of Christ over our lifetimes. My case was rather extreme. I've written about it in other books, but I feel I need to tell this story in a different way. If all goes well, it will take fewer than 498 pages this time. Here goes. It certainly could have been far worse. It's not like I believed God spoke through my parish priest, and then that priest touched me in the rectory or anything. Nothing as bad as that. Unlike a lot of people, who then really will need to work on that parish priest slash God distinction right away. But still, I felt that I had to choose between my meeting culture and my God, that they were opposed, that I could not simply try to do both. Far easier if you are able to just treat the two as the same thing. But not all of us can do that. Louisa writes,
"The beginning of my exit was the earthquake that suddenly occurred when I was 39, when I suddenly saw that the meeting and the Lord were separate, that the meeting did not accurately live out Christ to me. What a shock! As soon as I saw that, something inside me changed. I was no longer under the control of the meeting principle that dictated that we should never have contact with other Christians because of fear of contamination, although I didn't have any contact until after I left."
A lot of how much and how soon this conflict is thrust upon you often depends on the other Christians around you and how different their spirits are from Christ's. because not all communities are uniform in attitude and strictness. A lot of the time, it's not what people do and say and believe so much as how and why they do and say and believe things, what their heart is. Louisa writes about moving to work at a Christian publishing house in a different state in America.
In Nebraska, there were certain people you, quote, knew were legalists, but they were not the majority. It was a rude awakening for me when I moved to Michigan, as I suddenly experienced rigidity like I'd never had before. So many expressed and unexpressed rules, not only of what we were not to do or say or wear, but many expressed and unexpressed sentences as to what was expected of me, both in terms of, quote, godliness, and what I did with my non-work hours, which the meeting controlled. Yes, I let that happen.
What was happening to me was, I was starting to not want to help let this happen anymore. Things were about to get pretty real. It was terrifying. Taking things too seriously. Having since spoken to a lot of people with similar upbringings, I find that most of them had parents who taught them to look at what went on at church with a bit of what my grade 8 teacher Roy Kinch called a jaundiced eye, with a bit of cynicism. People who were taking things a bit too seriously, and the very fact itself that it was possible to take things too seriously, were being daily pointed out to some other people's kids by their parents, either overtly, in words, or by said parents clearly not taking those people and things terribly seriously at all. And that sounds very healthy, an essential life lesson. You can't take absolutely everything and everyone deadly seriously. But my parents didn't teach me that. Because they were those very people who were taking things too seriously. So as far as the people in my family were concerned, there was nothing wrong at our meeting that couldn't be fixed by taking it more seriously. If it wasn't working, the only conceivable solution was to do it more and harder. Louisa lost her parents, so she didn't have anyone to tell her not to take things too seriously either.
I was one who really believed what I heard in meeting and did not have a family to drive home with, where parents would talk to each other in front of their children about what they heard in the meeting. In the years since I left, when I've spoken with previous meeting folks, they often say to me, "You didn't believe all that, did you?" And I say, "Yes, of course. I did believe what was said in meetings, at conferences, and in the local assembly reading meetings."
Louisa, like me, is the sort of person who can't seem to help taking everything seriously, taking people at their word. Adolescence is about fitting in. It's about finding what kind of person you are and meeting up with others you can be yourself with. One of the main reasons I was never a part of my church youth group culture was that I took everything that was done and said at meeting far too seriously, thought about it too much, felt about it too deeply, and I didn't find others who were the same. Not for a long time. My cousin, who grew up to be one of the preachiest atheists I know, says that a culture like ours raises rebels and liars. I wasn't much of either of those, making me suspect a third option. I was more of a zealot, trying to make that system work for me by doing it harder. If you wanted to fit in with other teens, you needed that delicate balance of being somewhat into it all, but only to a point. I was well past that point at the best of times. I was definitely a zealot. A fanatic. There is a keen, high note of crazy in fanaticism. It doesn't help one get on in groups. If one is a zealot, one either has to lead in a group or go away. Into the wilderness is customary. But most people either tried to develop a rebel identity that involved transforming the church-trained shame into a form of rebellious pride and causing upset, or learned to deceive so as to be freer. Melody says,
"I became a liar. There seemed to be a lot of pressure for life to be going perfectly all the time. Many of my issues lie in an inability to communicate truthfully. I did not know how to be heart honest with people. I didn't know it was okay to be truthful from the heart because people in the assembly churches are not allowed to have problems, marital, depression, etc. If you had any issues like that, it meant you'd fallen away from the Lord, and you couldn't admit that."
On Humans of New York today, there is a picture of a girl, face carefully out of frame, in New York City, without her parents' knowledge, to visit her 55-year-old, 50 Shades of Grey-style, married boyfriend. She says,
"My father is the son of a missionary My parents would always do room searches where they'd go through my stuff and take anything they didn't agree with and break any CDs that they didn't think were Christian. I tried to hide things behind bookshelves. I even tried to create a hole in my wall, but nothing worked. I remember getting in trouble for leaning up against my friend at church. The youth pastor said we were acting like lesbians, and my mom said I was ruining her reputation. I've been on antidepressants since I was 14, which is the age my parents started taking me to psychiatrists to figure out what was wrong with me.
The psychiatrists, the antidepressants, and the room searches all sound like failed attempts to adjust and control this young girl to church normal. But there she is, having kinky sex with a married 55-year-old man in a different city. Control and limits to her freedom don't seem to be the answer to what's bothering her. In fact, she seeks out more of those two things than her parents or a psychiatrist would ever dole out in the form of something she receives as love from this man, an older guy with control and who puts limits on her freedom that extend to handcuffs, ball gags, and the like. Ruth quite convincingly claims full marks as having been a card-carrying zealot even before she'd hit her teenage years. She says,
I was a zealot, a book-burning, censorship-practicing, judge-anyone-as-unspiritual whose level of zeal didn't match mine zealot. I was a very Daniel who purposed within himself that he would not defile himself with the king's meat being whatever happened to be worldly. I became this zealot at 11 years old, when I first took my place at the Lord's table, the holy solemnity of the act and the grave responsibilities impressed upon my mind lifted me to what I can only explain as a kind of religious ecstasy. It was at this time in my life that I began to read the Bible, and I read through the entire Bible on my own, even those jawbreakers in Chronicles and inexplicable Ezekiel, liberally marking it up with pink and yellow highlighters and pen notes from the reading meetings. One time during this period of my life, I was staying overnight with a brethren family. I was hanging out with my friend, more like acquaintance, whom I grew up with and saw every week, according to my current definition of friendship, when her brother called upstairs that everyone was going for a nighttime swim in the swimming pool, and hurry up and get changed so we could join in. Now, growing up, I loved swimming more than any other sport. I felt a thrill of delight and excitement shoot through me at the idea of swimming at night in an outdoor pool. Very dangerous feeling. Let's go, my friend entreated. Let me just read my 2 chapters of the Bible for the night before I go do fun stuff, I replied. Dutifully, I covered my head with my lace mantilla and read my chapters. I cannot say I got anything out of the reading. Too excited. Now I'm going to pray, I announced after I finished reading. By the time I finished my devotions and got downstairs, the other kids were already out of the swimming pool and the opportunity was over forever. But I was pleased with myself in spite of the bitter disappointment. I had put the Lord first.
Ruth then goes on to talk about how the chief among the various Mrs. Hayhoes was quoted as having said that the children who ended up staying in the meeting, the ones who continued going on well for him, were not the ones who went off by themselves, even to read the Bible, and so on. The ones who went off on their own were the first ones to leave, the Mrs. Hayhoe had said. At the time, Ruth said she felt that things like night swims and all those worldly Star Trek books she gave up to read the latest Christian Treasury and Notes of Interest and other booklets of written ministry were sacrificed for nothing. It's almost like what determined whether a person stayed in the meeting had more to do with how much of a group person they already were. It's almost like the system did little to serve individualists. But then, what system does much for individualists? Ruth did leave in time, so there is no doubt something to what the Mrs. Hayhoe said. I heard the same thing from others. Going off on your own as a young person was a troubling sign of individuality and a disinterest in playing with others. Jake, raised in a more mainstream, definitely not Brethren church, and working with youth group kids, says,
I was made aware of them as I began to question things and grow up to be confident in Jesus for myself, not just being wholly validated by my parents' approval. What strung together all of these unwritten rules was fear.
Mary writes, as to rebels, liars, and zealots,
I think I did some of all three. Rebelled against legalism in mostly passive-aggressive ways. Zealously judged those who rebelled more openly, while kind of envying them also. and tried to keep all the rules, at least on the surface, making me a liar, doing what I didn't believe in while feeling guilty for doing so.
Anne also judged people who broke rules when she was an adolescent. She says,
"Yeah, I told on someone who was drinking. It was against the rules, and you are responsible to report them if they are breaking the rules. Otherwise, you are complicit. It was really simple. Until it wasn't."
Darlene says,
"The hostile leaders produced hostile and nasty children who grew up to resemble them. Young people meetings were a session of showing off, learned from their parents for many years. Who had the best hat, the best clothes, the best car? If you were unable to have these things, you were ignored. It didn't matter if you were a beautiful person inside. It only mattered what you looked like on the outside. Lots of boring men made rules that made me feel that there was no meaning to life."
On a less serious note, Anne adds,
"Another time I was traveling in a third world country with another meeting girl, and we were staying with a family, and they had a TV, but they hid it in a bedroom. And one evening we were asking, 'Where are you guys?' And they were in the room watching TV, and they sheepishly let us see it, probably a soccer game. It was a tiny TV. I think I have a photo of some people looking uncomfortably at me while I photographed the evidence, just because I thought it was funny. I was kind of teasing them by taking a picture."
Some brethren families had a TV hidden somewhere. I'll never know how many. Some people threw a quilt or Afghan thing over it. And many brethren had Narnia-style wardrobes, so you could close the door to hide the TV sitting inside there. Instead of Aslan, there was the A-Team. It was like people who smoke pot. If you had someone visiting who was known to likewise indulge, you might reveal the TV and watch something. Apart from that, it was kept safely stashed away. Unless you were a rebel, then you openly mentioned TV shows you'd watch standing right in front of the meeting hall just to be a badass. As for me, I wanted to work the system, not fight or evade it, make it pay off, be successful in it, work hard at it. An odd thing is that once one shows one is going for gold, that one wants platinum member full Pharisee status, people treat one differently. Kids avoided me because they knew they couldn't trust me not to inwardly judge their rule-breaking and pleasure-seeking, couldn't trust me not to look down on them and maybe even gossip about it. And adults had used me as an example for their kids before I hit high school. Why couldn't they show an interest in meeting like I did? For their part, their kids knew better than to want to be more like me. And then adults and other platinum members sometimes warn people like me not to hang out with certain others, at risk of losing our platinum member status. Johann remembers years ago at a brethren camp being taken aside by the hey-ho in charge and privately told that Steve,
a fun young guy I was enjoying hanging out with, due to his liveliness, wasn't a fitting companion for a Christian.
Steve was from the world and wasn't responding quickly enough to brethren indoctrination. So of course Johann stopped hanging out with Steve immediately. It was like that. I heard of and witnessed this "don't hang out with him, he's worldly" thing all too often. It was very competitive. It was beyond stressful to keep up with. Carol says,
"I was always watching myself, watching other people, watching me, watch myself, with God watching the whole lot of us. Sheesh. My worldly, non-Taylor brethren, work colleagues, eventually told me some months after I left the Taylorites that us brethren girls even walked differently to others. More nose in the air, I was told when I asked. And I still had and have that walk and that feeling of being watched by others, I think. Ugh."
I know of no reason why or mechanism for so many of us growing up to speak with flat, monotone voices and to walk without twisting at the waist or moving our hips more than is absolutely necessary to walk with, but still, somehow. Louisa adds,
"They were everywhere, always assessing me, and I always came up short. I never passed the test to become fully, unconditionally accepted. I remember how impossible it was to fit. If you were more legalistic or more loose than what was room temperature for a given clique, That was it for you.
I'd been born into my church culture, so indoctrination into it happened without my choosing it or knowing what was going on. I no more would have used the term my culture back then than a fish would think much about water and pollution. But I was like the proverbial frog in a pot of water on a stove, which pot is slowly being heated up to boiling. If I didn't make a jump of some kind, that was going to be it for me. It was killing me, literally. Louisa, having lost her parents young, writes,
I spent a significant amount of time with legalists. I was impressionable, and they were thorough in indoctrinating me. For about 15 years after I left the meeting, my dreams at night were of these people, or me having to be at a meeting conference, or I was still working at the Brethren Publishing House. I had a fear/pride/desire to be what would be perceived as godly. To be in the innermost circle. I craved parenting, thus many felt permission to instruct me, and I heard these, quote, godly ones speaking ill of those who walked the fence between the meeting and the camp, or who were borderline worldly, whatever is that. So I towed the mark as best I could, and in the end it utterly exhausted me to the point where I had a nervous breakdown about a year after I first went to the publishing house.
Like Louisa, I didn't really rebel. Given my upbringing, family, and fanatic nature, I tried to do meeting more, harder, and it started to break me. Eventually, I was having trouble even leaving my bedroom, let alone showing up at meeting events in school. But the show had to go on, didn't it? I had to appear 5 times each week and get good reviews, all to maintain that coveted lofty position of being viewed as especially decent and acceptable. In one sense, we all felt deeply insignificant. Our thoughts and feelings could not have mattered less to anyone. In another way, we were always in the spotlight, our every smallest move being scrutinized and discussed in our absence by people with no internet or televisions to otherwise pass the time. We knew our souls were being discussed and found wanting. Living the meeting life eventually made me want very much to be dead. I was raised a Christian, but I was lost in a very real way, like a lot of people I knew. Not as to an afterlife, but certainly as to the life I had to face each day. I had been set adrift. Meeting didn't work for me, yet I couldn't let go of the idea of God. I was stuck. Yes, adrift but stuck. My metaphors are mixed. They are lambs to the mire. And because I was caught in those cracks I was falling between, I really started to show the strain. It could not be hidden. Endless horrific nightmares, dizzy spells, months of depression punctuated by suicidal urges, lethargy, and despondency. You are rooted in your culture, and your culture is rooted deep into you, like your teeth, like your lungs. And I felt all of that being slowly torn out of me. It felt like God and reality were pulling me in one direction, and my culture, family, and social milieu were pulling me almost as hard in the other. The simple solution would be to say that I was just depressed and needed pills because something was wrong with me. That was, of course, what my family doctor said. He also went to our church. But the reality is that I had stuff to work through, and the system and culture I was trying to force myself to belong to and succeed in was a problem rather than a help. In fact, the whole system was deeply suspicious and fearful of anyone who was even trying to work through much of anything, because that person was evidence of the system not being enough, not being right for everyone just as it was. People who work at McDonald's aren't supposed to bring Burger King food in and eat it. People in Kentucky Fried Chicken uniforms aren't supposed to wear them into Dairy Queen to eat at lunchtime. To this day, I meet some people who can get by in meeting circles, and others, often their siblings, who simply can't. To get by, you just have to show up, sit there, and not be discontented or restless. You don't have to look like you love it, but you have to never look like you're looking elsewhere. You can't look dissatisfied and searching. You can say, well, it's not perfect, but... You have to have a but at the end, one which signifies that your own will remain in that chair each Lord's Day morning to perpetuity. I wasn't looking elsewhere, but I was having trouble even showing up. And when I did, my responses to other people were not the required placidly contented ones. I slowly realized that my meeting culture was poisoning me. It was toxic. I talked to every understanding brethren person I could find to ask for advice, and they offered sympathy but pretty much zero insight. The process I was going through was unstoppable. It went better when I helped it happen. Throughout my 20s, I gradually left much of my culture behind in my thinking and living, parsing the God from the meeting as the years went by. By the time they kicked me out, the nightmares and all the rest had long since mostly faded. But I didn't just take off running or throw the baby Jesus out with the holy water. There was a whole lot of wrestling that went on before, during, and after. This book was going to be called Wrestling with God. Unfortunately, there are roughly 500 Christian books already called that, with all of my very own cover ideas, so I had to take a different path. Maybe most people just aren't like I was. I know that many simply go off and rebel for a while, drinking, dancing, drugging, whoring, gambling, voting, or whatever, and then get it worked out of their systems, usually by around the time they have their first child. Then they can come right back in, repent of it all, and help out the meeting by warning kids not to do what worked out so very well for them as compared to, say, me, who didn't rebel. They can be the returned, celebrated prodigals while I get to be the emo elder brother. And I know that for many other people, church and God and all that stuff has simply never been a very big deal to begin with. It had never really taken root. So as adults, they now can simply take it or leave it. They don't need it. It doesn't hurt them either. It's just not important. Many of these people prefer to keep their church life going a bit. Unless things go beyond a certain point, of course. Some even tell me that although they don't necessarily believe all of what is said at church, in some cases much of anything that's said there, including the idea of there literally being a God, still, they believe it's good stuff to say, and good stuff to listen to, and a good thing for children to hear especially, that it will provide some basic ethics, as if you can't get ethics any other way than at church. They speak as if they believe that religion isn't exactly true, but it makes people behave better, so you should tell it to kids. But it really wasn't like that for me at all either. All this meeting stuff was the only hell of which I believe I will ever know the torment. I know there are many like me out there, and so I'm writing this for you and for anyone else who's interested. I know not everyone is like me. I know not everyone had my experience of meeting, but I think we should get a book too, one without a sunset on the cover. I know there are people who could thrive in their church culture. Mostly, they got their hands on power and influence and remade things there somewhat to be more comfortable. They tend to maintain power and influence for their whole lives, even if it means being an assembly with maybe two last names represented in total, theirs being the most important. I have trouble being heard by those kinds of people. They don't see why it's so hard. Just get along, they say. Get involved. Make stuff work. Contribute. So I ask if I can help out at their church. With, you know, the stuff that I'm best at, reading, writing, speaking, teaching, music, the stuff I'm paid to do in the world outside their micro church. This has always brought the conversation to an abrupt close.